I don't know how we're going to do this. I think we're stuck with the online because there's so many people from all over the country and sometimes out of the country from other places that are come regularly. I don't know how we do in person too much anymore. It's going to have to be a hybrid, I guess, all the time. Anyway, I'm so glad we're talking about this subject because rituals and devotion. For those of you that are new here, Tim and I pick a yearly topic that we talk about in Dhamma. And this year it happens to be Dhamma in everyday life. So each month we take a different subject matter and look at it in relation to the Dhamma. So we've looked at wealth and we've looked at relationships and we've looked at death. And this month happens to be rituals and devotion as part of our everyday life. And today I'm going to talk about the downside of this. And I think Suze's poem was perfect for what I want to talk about. The, you know, even just Hafiz really brings home the point that everything we do is sacred. And it is everything. So what that means for a Buddhist or a practitioner is that even our unskillful, harmful behavior is sacred. It's hard for us to grasp that because we tend to think that only the good stuff is sacred, but we don't really notice that when we go afoul, when we go against the path or we move in a direction that is not in keeping with the path, that is still sacred. And it's and that is what it is that we're beginning to look at. So what it's kind of a catch-22, and it often is in the Dhamma. The more you practice with it, the more there's sort of like a you're practicing to get to know yourself, and then at the same time, there's this whole body of practice that says there's no self, and you're practicing to kind of like be with the precepts in this ethical way, but at the same time, you're supposed to notice the presence of anger and the absence of anger. So there's always this kind of way in which the Dhamma says, go forward, and then it says, oh, but don't go too forward, you know, go, you know, do this, but don't do this. And it's always felt like in the beginning of my practice that when I was trying to find the right way to be, that was a conflict. Somehow it wasn't working together. But the more I've practiced, the more I come to understand, I know exactly what this is pointing to. And rituals and devotion is a great way to see this. Because what I think it's pointing to is the practice has to be yours. If there was just an edict that said everybody has to do this, then we'd all try to do that. And we would begin to think that the doing of that is all I have to do in order to be enlightened. But that is not the truth of what enlightenment is. It's way, way too subtle and sublime for that. So instead, rituals and devotion is a great way to show what it is that we're doing. So think about anybody that's ever done any sacred practice, sacred rituals, devotion. The awe of it. Like sometimes if you go out into the woods and you're sitting there and you're in this place and the awe of nature and the awe of the capacity of the sacredness of nature is such a pleasant experience. And oftentimes, like even when we come to Sangha, there have been times when we've been in here and we've had these discussions and the whole room seems to be alive with wisdom, and there's a pleasant kind of a drawing in about those experiences. There's something about hearing that community statement that we made years ago when we started this, Sid, and still every time I hear it, I remember, you know, the preciousness of this Sangha and how precious it was when we first created it. When we first created it, it was really to find a way to have parents and their kids come. So all of this things that I'm talking about, these are all rituals. They're all devotional practice. They all help us come to an appreciation of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, all of it. And it's so important that we have that sacredness, that the devotional piece of practice, so we can stay. Because the truth is, the secret teaching that we never really talk about is what we're really practicing with is some hard stuff. We are really looking at some difficult, painful things. It is not easy to pay attention when you've yelled at someone, or when you were thinking all this negative, judging, criticism, hatred stuff, even if you didn't say it out loud. You know you were thinking it. It's not easy to look at that by any stretch of the imagination. But when you do it in the context of what is sacred, and you hold it within the context of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, now all of a sudden, this becomes like curiosity, investigation, wisdom, understanding, and that sacredness keeps us on the path. That devotion, these rites or these rituals that we go through, they keep us on the path. That's why we're doing these practices. This is why Sangha is so important. Why the Buddha said that Sangha was the whole of the practice. Because if we're all in here in this room together, we'll stay committed to looking at anger and looking at desire and looking at our clinging, worrying, restlessness. We'll stay committed to look at it. I will, if you will. It's that kind of a felt sense experience relationship we're having here. But there is a pitfall with rituals and devotion. Because of the pleasantness that comes from it, we can begin to think that my very acts is the thing that is going to bring me towards enlightenment. That we begin to think that it is just the attending of the sit, where I have such a wonderful time and I'm with my friends and we're all connected and we all feel safe. And that alone is what is going to bring my wisdom further. And then I mistakenly, without intention, I stop actually practicing. I just come to the sits and I'm with everybody and we're together and it's great. Or I say the refuges and the precepts, I say them, but I'm not really checking myself as I go about my day, which is the second part of Sue's reading Hafiz's poem that I really, really enjoyed, was this constant referencing to what is alive in this moment. Can I be with whatever is arising in this moment as a sacred part of practice? And this is what I think the Buddha was pointing to. Because, you know, he awoke in a world where ritual and devotion was all over the place, oozing all over in India. And the main difficulty was Brahmins were born into sacredness. So just imagine, this is some of the problem with white supremacy. Imagine all of us are Brahmins and we're all born into sacredness. How much effort do we have to put into our behavior? So as soon as a Brahmin, there's a really nice I think it's a story. I don't think it's a sutta, but of a Dalit woman who's like washing some things in a river, and this Brahmin comes early morning hours to bathe himself in the river so he can wash himself clean of all his sins. And she is a practitioner. And she says, well, what are you coming here? And he's like, well, I'm going to wash myself clean and then I'm going to be good. I can start all over again, you know, like clean the slate. She's like, yeah, no, that doesn't work. You can do it, but it doesn't work. It's not going to clean you. You're still going to have the same behavior. And if you want to liberate your mind, if you want to be free, you're going to have to liberate your mind. And so it's sort of like it was a spark to open him. But sometimes that's the way we get as practitioners. We think the food we eat, you know, whether or not we do our meditation, whether or not we do this or that, or we're like this, and I don't listen to violence, and I don't talk about violence, and I don't watch violent movies, and I don't do this, and I do that, and I do this. And all our actions are the thing that's going to bring us closer to awakening. But what we don't then look at is the places where we are unskillful, the places where we're harmful, the places that are painful, because nobody wants to look at the places that are painful. So the practice, the sacredness and the devotion, the awe and the pleasure that comes with that is to get us at the gate, to get us in a place where we're willing to look at difficulty. There's a level of practice. This is the last thing I want to talk about, but there's a level of practice where when you get to this certain level of practice, you're at the gate. And from then on, you are walking in a whole new world. A way to think of it is it's called like opening the Dhamma eye. So we go through life in our ordinary way of looking at things, me, mine, and what is, and how I was raised, that's how I perceive the world. What my people think, that's how I look at the world. I want to be like everybody else, all my friends, we all do this, this is our thing. But then when you raise this Dhamma eye, you can begin to challenge some of the things you see. So even if your whole clan does it this way, you're like, yeah, no, I can't do it like that. We begin to see things in a broader, more universal way. And we're not trapped within the film of the way we were raised. And three areas that show that you are not trapped in some preset way of thinking has to do with the sort of the cessation or the calming or the letting go of three areas. The first is self-identity. Most people think that means I know there's no self here. There's no Tuere here. But no, I'm not really an angry person. I mean, there's something about me. I'm not really averse. Yes, I am averse. I'm on the aversive side. So I'm going to criticize things first. I'm not on the greedy side where I'm going to see the beauty and the optimism in things. But self-identity means I don't think that is who I am as a permanent person. It means that I know that I may be averse in this moment, but I may be greedy in another moment. And I may be deluded in another moment. It means I may be nice today, but I know I could get up tomorrow and I could be kind of grumbly and mean. I know I am fluid in that way. And there's no set me as a being, as a person that you can see and say, oh, yeah, that's Tuareg. She's always like that. So there's no need to be shocked if you, hey, someone said, oh, I heard Tuareg yelled at somebody. Yes, 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 that's what Tuareg would do. And then you could see, oh, I heard Tuareg did this really nice thing. She was so kind in the way she answered that question. Yes, yes, that's me too. So there's a way in which you see yourself as more, as impermanent and not stuck in a this is me. That's the first kind of way. Likewise, there is a way in which you no longer doubt that the Buddha awakened. You don't doubt that the Dhamma is the path to awakening, and you don't doubt the importance of the Sangha in helping you remain on the path to awakening. So you have faith in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Each one of us have to come to that understanding on our own. This is what I think rituals and devotion get us to. Get us to stop hating ourselves, stop trying to fix ourselves, stop trying to make ourselves be a permanent being and allow for whatever mistakes we make here and there. We trust the Dhamma, we trust the path, we trust our practice. And the last thing is we let go of what's called rituals, habits, rituals and rites and rituals. And what I think that is pointing to is we stop thinking that our liberation is going to come from specific acts. And instead, we begin to notice that liberation is going to come from how we relate to any given moment, how we relate to what we're actually doing. Can I be with what's arising in this moment? Can I get interested in this moment to whatever's happening and see how it's lining up? Can I get interested in my reactivity, not because I'm a bad person and I need to fix myself, but because what is it about this reactivity? What is that pattern? Why does that keep showing up? What should I do for this? Can I see that continuously doing this pattern leads to more suffering and letting go of the clinging can lead to liberation? Can I see that? Because I'm interested in it, not because I need to somehow tighten myself up and fix myself so I can be more, you know, this is who I am. This is the line that we're working with rituals and devotion. Both the pleasure of it that brings us into the Dhamma, brings us aligned with the Dhamma, awakens our energy, brings all this love for the practice and the camaraderie of being together. And at the same time, we have to keep a keen eye that we don't tumble over into thinking the ritual is what is important and that we stay in the present moment. What is alive right here, right now? So the way I thought, usually we have a time where we get together and we talk. And I want to open up this conversation with you. And what I thought would be a great way to approach this is to, we're going to take a couple of moments here while anyone that wants to leave can leave. We always give a space for people who want to leave to leave. And then those of you that want to go into the breakout rooms, I want you to think about a ritual that you do in relation to practice, that you do it without even thinking about it, right? You do it, you don't even, it's like some people get up every morning and they sit, and they just get up every morning and they sit. They sit, they sit, they sit, they sit, they sit, and then they leave, and they're done. And they don't sit anymore, they just sit that morning. But many of their sits, they don't even remember they sat. They just sort of get up and do it by rote. So I want you to think of what is something that you do by rote, but that really, if you begin to look at it more deeply, you really are missing an opportunity to more deeply see the present moment. Is it helping you look at the present moment, or is it just something that you do? Does this make sense what I'm asking you? Everybody okay? Okay. Just raise your hand if you have a question. I just want to, I want us to see if we can begin to look at some of these things that we do and whether or not we are doing them to help us on the path, or are we just doing them to do them and we don't even see how they're helping us on the path or use them to help us on the path. That's what I'd like us to do. So let's take a moment, and anyone that wants to leave can bow out. You can say goodbye in the chat or unmute yourself and say goodbye. And I will begin making the groups while we do that. And then the rest of us that are going to stay, we can just kind of think to ourselves, what would we like to share? I like that we do this sharing. So the reason why we do this is because it's not just what you hear in the Dhamma, and it's not just what you contemplate in the Dhamma. It's the talking with each other that helps us begin to flesh out what's really true for me when we talk to each other. So that's what we're doing here. So let me just create these groups right quick. Okay, so I'll open the groups here. Let's take 15 minutes, so I'll bring you back at 10 after. That's about 5 minutes apiece. All right, let's see if there's anyone that would like to share anything that they noticed. We'll take maybe a couple or so, if anybody has anything. Did you learn something? You can start there, you know? I will.
You can go to the...
Hello, Lillian. Yeah.
Okay, good.
Who's there? Ah, thank you.
Yeah, I think something interesting that came up during our group was kind of talking about how mindlessness can sometimes enter your mindful practice. And I think, you know, one thing I really appreciated about the Susan's meditation today was that the reminder of this is what this moment is like, and this is what, you know, restlessness is like, or this is what, you know, what this thing I'm feeling is like. Because I think for me, sometimes I almost go on autopilot of, oh, I'm distracted, going back to, you know, the breath or sound or whatever kind of that focal point is. And I think just being more mindful of, you know, where your mind is at that moment of what that moment is helpful for knowing what you're experiencing or what you're feeling and being able to be more aware of it outside of, you know, just your practice. So,
yeah, that's right. That's good. That's good. Because the sitting is really to be aware of what's arising in the sitting, not just the sitting. So, yes, that's exactly what I'm pointing to.
Thanks.
Who finds talking about devotional stuff difficult? Not really that kind of devotional person. Yes, yeah, Charlotte, what's difficult about it?
Well, It took me a long time getting over being a Catholic and the rituals of the Catholic Church, and there's so much focus towards the God and the priest. And it took me a long time to come inside myself. So I guess there's a little fear that that will happen to me again with devotional practices. Will I lose the inner life to the ritual life?
Well, actually, you're bringing up the point that I was making. That's what it is. So the rituals are what get you to be willing to look inside. That's all those rituals are supposed to help you do. And if the rituals are helping you stay with the looking inside, regard your internal practice, regardless of what's going on internally, and you're not avoiding the difficult or avoiding that which is challenging to see, then you're actually practicing as practice is meant to be. That is the point of it. You see? So that dichotomy you're pointing to is exactly what I think the Buddha was pointing to when he was talking about the fetter of rituals and habits, because people got, you can get so caught on the rituals that you're not really paying attention to what's actually going on. So what you're pointing to, actually the rituals help you get to your inner self. And once you get to your inner self, you pretty much let go of the rituals and you stay there with the inner self. Good. Michelle?
Well, I'd like to answer the flip side of that question, which is that for the first, I don't know, decade of my practice, I was really caught up in doing it the right way. And I would say that most of my teachers were also more mental. And then I started training with people who had more devotional perspective. And I was able to start accepting myself in my practice and the uniqueness of my own experience. And I just had such a need for that kindness. Like I was saying, how much, like the metta is such an aliveness for me, because it's really helped me to stay with the practice and be less, really, like there's a right way to do it.
Yes, that's right. That's right. That's what we're pointing to. That's so that this becomes part of your everyday life, because it is what helps you stay connected to who you are. Great. Sadie?
Going back to your question on finding it difficult with ritual and devotion, I think for me, I don't know where it got planted in my head, but it was early in my life. I guess I always, growing up Episcopalian, like ritual and devotion just always meant like something theistic, relating to a god, relating to a religion. And I don't know, I think when I first started Buddhism, I thought it was supposed to be less of a religion and more of a way of thought. So it almost seems like ritual and devotion don't go with Buddhism, because I see it as something separate from something that I would do in my day-to-day life, because the spirituality, the way I grew up with it, was kind of separate. You do that on Sunday and then you live the rest of your life. So
think of ritual and devotion in terms of Dhamma as what gets you to be willing and committed to stay with the investigation of the path, regardless of what comes in your way. What is it that gets you to keep that intention to follow the path? And as Suze was pointing out with Hafiz's poem, to see everything on the path as sacred and very much part of the wisdom of the path. That's what rituals and devotions are to do, to get you on the path. They are not the path. They are the thing that gets us on the path and keeps us on the path. And so the rituals can be as simple as showing up on a Sunday morning for a sit, right? That is as simple as what it is. But even still, it's not the showing up on Sunday morning. It's that the showing up on Sunday morning is what helps me stay on the path, stay with the practice, stay in this mode of the sacredness of investigating the nature of mind. And so that's what it is that the rituals and the devotional practice is pointing to in our everyday life to get us to continue on this path. Okay? John or Jean?
Same thread here. I was remembering in a tradition we used to practice in, they had the expression sacred outlook, and was kind of that wasn't stated right at the beginning of their path. It was sort of later on. It's like, oh, everything, we could always bring a sacred outlook to whatever, to taking a walk, to noticing things around us, you know, and it is like a moment, not that I practice that very consistently, but it's kind of like anything can be a moment of waking up.
Yeah. I remember the first time I heard myself kind of, my sister and I used to fight all the time. And I always thought that it was her fault. She, of course, thought it was my fault, but you know, she was wrong. It was her fault. And I remember one day in the midst of an argument, hearing myself say, "She's so arrogant. She's so snobbish and arrogant." Right? I remember hearing myself say that. And I remember the sacredness of actually hearing myself say the judgment I thought was her. Actually, Deborah's very smart. So, you know, she's one of those kind of people that are extremely smart. So her vocabulary is way over the heads of most people. Words that she uses commonly, no one in our family understands. We're like, "Did you understand that? I didn't get that." So even her jokes are over everybody's head, you know. So what I took as arrogance was really just smart. And that the reason why I'm pointing to that, Jean, is because that is what got me to let go of my judgment around my sister. Because when I heard it and I heard the judgment, I didn't hear it as something bad. I heard it as, "Oh, that's why I'm having so much difficulty." I heard the sacredness of it. The, "Oh, this is why this is so difficult for me. It's because I think she's arrogant, but that doesn't mean that's what she is." And so I asked her, were you trying to put me down just now?" And she was like mortified, like, "No." So there's this way in which if we hold everything as sacred, even the things that we don't like about ourselves, if we hold it as sacred, then we can begin to inch up close to it and investigate its nature without running away. Because the most difficult part of Dhamma is that when people see just how harmful they actually are, their immediate response is, "Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that. Okay, back it all up. Okay, that's not me. That's not who I am. Let's make sure everybody knows that." That is the problem. You got to be willing to hear that or see that behavior pattern and not put up a shade, pull down the shade, close the curtains, and you got to be able to see it. And that means it has to be sacred so that you don't see it as another thing proving you're a bad person. And you see it as, like Sue said, this opportunity to see and investigate. That's what that sacredness of everything is to kind of help us stay with the difficult. Pauline, you'll be the last one then.
Thank you. Yeah, I was at the beginning struggling with a question I share with my group. I couldn't think of any routine or ritual I do every day because life has just become crazy with pandemic and two little kids at home. So I thought there's one thing I do every day is I think about getting to meditation. I think about it. I want to meditate because that's, you know, is what you're supposed to do if you're practicing. But so the talk today, with everybody sharing and your talk, it really kind of liberated me a little bit. You know, that's not the goal. You know, it's like the finger pointing to the moon. The finger pointing over there is not it's not the goal. It's a way of getting there. So there are many other, like you said, every moment is sacred, and every moment I can pay attention to myself, pay attention that's to right. my surroundings, and that's practicing. So thank
that's
you.
That's right. Even with the littlest one having a temper tantrum, that is a sacred moment because you can see the hindrances that might be showing up, the wanting this not to be, the not wanting it, you know, all of it. You can see the hindrances in that moment. You could also see spaciousness if you happen to be spacious in that moment. That moment in and of itself is the entire practice. It's not when we go on the cushion and sit down. It's when we, I think it was Michelle said, I can't remember who it was that said, we turn inward. Oh, no, Charlotte, it's the turning inward in this moment and being willing to be with it. And the devotion, the sacredness, the rites, the rituals, these are the things that help us do that. And that's it. And once we start turning inward, then we're going to let go of those as crutches, and we're going to just stay with what we see. You see that? Very good.